And now in 20 minutes, you're going to have a dialogue with the scientists here at the Niels Bohr Institute. Mm-hmm. It's been some decades since your ideas have been presented here, hasn't it?
Yes. Well, I came here in 1957 for 1 month in the summer, and then again in 58. Now, at that time, I was just moving from Israel to England, and we spent a month here at the Institute. And, you know, we talked about physics mostly at that time.
Do you find that the kind of ideas that you present are easily understood in an environment like the Bohr Institute?
Well, I haven't tried the Bohr Institute yet. I just came. But I think that scientists find it harder in some ways than many other people, you see, than some of other people. Because there's still a strong commitment, even perhaps partly unconscious, to the old atomistic worldview.
So what you're saying is that science has shown us something that scientists do not want to see.
Well, they become so used to the way of seeing it that they don't want to change it. You see, they feel uncomfortable about changing it, and they feel there's no reason to change it, many of them. They say, well, we're doing so well now, why should we change it? In one sense, it looks as if we're doing very well, you see, but if you look at the broader view, it looks very dangerous.
Now, many people are talking about this new worldview that's coming up these years. Do you see a new worldview coming up in the Western world?
Well, in a certain part of the Western world, yes. I think a worldview in which there's more focus on wholeness, on process, rather than on analysis into parts and more static constituents.
But does that come up because we want it or because we are forced to take on it?
Well, probably both. I mean, that is, I think a certain fraction of the people want it. Perhaps they're tired of the old one, they don't feel it's working. And also there is some evidence for it, I think, especially in physics and probably in other sciences as well. The evidence in physics comes partly from relativity and partly from quantum theory, or perhaps more from quantum theory than relativity.
And what kind of evidence is that?
Well, in relativity, we have a notion of a universal field, which is a dynamic, flowing, and according to Einstein, particles should eventually emerge out of this as singularities or very strong regions of a stable pulses of field, which gradually merge, the fields gradually merge with other particles. So we have an unbroken universe, which is in constant flow dynamically. And even the very notions of space and time have become relative, so which were previously absolute. And they may even go on to singularities like the black hole or the supposed beginning of the universe, where the present laws would break down altogether, all concepts that we know. So that's a very revolutionary view compared with what we had, say, a century ago. And then there's quantum theory, which perhaps is more revolutionary. And it's hard to explain that in a short time, but there are three main features, I'd say. One is the notion that a quantum process is in some sense indivisible, that it is one whole which cannot, it can be broken, but then it becomes an entirely different process, so each process is a whole, otherwise it can't be what it is, and all the quantum processes of movement are linked, as it were, into one whole. Now, the second point is the wave-particle duality, the discovery that, say, electrons, which are normally and classically particles, can behave statistically like waves in a more precise experiment, and light, which is classically a wave, can behave like a particle in a more precise experiment. So it seems we have these two aspects which depend on how the system is treated, context-dependent, which is quite different from the classical idea that whether it's a wave or a particle is intrinsic. Now, the third point was what's called non-locality, that we find that in certain conditions, there's apparently an immediate connection of distant particles. It's rather hard to explain. We can't use it for signals, but still it seems to be there. It's connected with the experiment of Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, and has been checked by, you know, they've been tested by Bell's theorem and Hasbeck's experiment. It seems pretty well established, right? Both theoretically and experimentally. Now, this, again, all of these you see combined to the notion that the universe is a kind of indivisible whole rather than analyzed into constituent elements which interact as separately existent.
But how much can you tell about this indivisible whole?
Well, we can tell quite a bit in the sense that all the laws of quantum mechanics are concerned with it, you see. I mean, you can tell, I don't know what you want to know, but I mean, all the laws, you compute the properties of all sorts of things. You know, like, for example, take superconductivity. You know, electron at high temperatures, electrons will generally scatter off obstacles and metals, and therefore there will be a resistance. You see, well, the current flow would stop unless it's maintained by a voltage. Right? At very low temperatures in certain metals, the current flows indefinitely without scattering. Now, this is a quantum effect, you see. Now, if you analyze it, you can see that it's due to the fact that the electrons are sort of locked, held together in some way by these non-local interactions. So that if there's an obstacle, they go around and reform rather than scatter. It's rather like a ballet dance, the people going around and reforming, whereas in a crowd, each person is following his own purpose and they all scatter, they all get in each other's way.
So this unity also creates a kind of ordering of things.
Yes, it can create a kind of ordering of things, but at the same time it explains, you see, you can see that there are situations where we have this high degree of order and others where we don't, that it's possible within the mathematics to see that when something called the wave function can be represented as a set of product of independent factors, and all the particles behave independently, but in a more general situation they don't. So you can explain why we have so much independence in ordinary experience, and yet why in a more careful probing we find order, right? New kinds of order. So the classical level, Newtonian level, is explained by quantum mechanics as a limiting case, you see, of a more, so that you have a whole, but the whole determines itself to behave somewhat like independent parts in many cases. So even whether it's going to be behaving like parts is determined by the whole, right?
But what we can see is the parts rather than
well,
the whole.
Well, we see, in physics, we see the parts because that's the way we approached them the last few centuries. I don't know if, you see, I think our perception is influenced by our way of thinking so that we accept this mechanical way of looking at things. But if you went back 1,000 or 2,000 years, I don't think people actually saw the parts as primary. The way we see it depends on the way we think, you see.
But is it a choice? Do we have to choose between the whole and the parts?
No. Well, you see, it's a question of whether you have a holistic approach which puts the whole as primary. See, in classical physics, the parts are the primary concept, and the whole is only an auxiliary concept, which is convenient for when you have many parts working together like a machine. But the parts are taken as the basic reality, right? And saying we find it convenient to think about the whole. But in quantum mechanics, I think there's something else, that the whole is objective, and the parts are the result of analysis. But we have large areas where the whole behaves to some extent like independent parts.
So you're saying it's really us that make up the parts.